Welcome to The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with us this week is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. Great to be here again, as always. And we're going to continue on with our recap of Knife of Dreams.
Yes, with luck, this will be the conclusion of our multiple-part series, How to Get Knifed in Your Sleep.
Yeah, exactly. Perhaps to balance on the blade, on the path of daggers, who knows?
Before we begin, in the last podcast, we decided to issue a challenge to the listeners. As many of you will have noticed during our recap of Knife of Dreams, we've been trying to do a few more creative spoiler warnings. Things to let people know that if they haven't read through all the books within the series, that we discuss everything here in the Fourth Age, and you probably want to tune out. So if anyone in the listening audience has a creative idea on how to warn people about spoilers, this would be the time to record something, convert it into an MP3, and send it to us at podcast@dragonmount.com. If you do not have the equipment to do a recording, or you just aren't confident in your ability to make such a performance, you can, of course, always write up a script and send it to us at The Fourth Age. We've got a lot of very, very talented people, and we really, really do enjoy coming up with new and interesting ways to warn people that there will be spoilers in our podcasts.
Yeah, so this is your unofficial challenge. I don't know if we can actually make this a contest, per se, mainly because I don't think we have any goodies to give out. But we definitely want to hear your submissions, and we'll just pick out all the ones that we like and think are appropriate and start incorporating them into the podcast.
Yes, if you are lucky, you could hear your spoiler warnings on The Fourth Age. Whether your own voice or ours, you can always find new ways to help tell other people that there will be spoilers in the podcasts.
Yeah, I wonder how many times you've actually said that over the years. I guess many.
Definitely. And if by this point in time you do not realize that there will be spoilers in this podcast,
then you deserve...
This is the final time I will say.
Yeah, if you don't realize it by now, you deserve to have your fun ruined.
True. Very, very true. So, you have been warned. There will be spoilers in this podcast.
Well, anyway, the other thing I want to say before we get started is that... you may have noticed in the last few podcasts I've been a little under the weather. So I apologize for my voice being a little bit muted and raspy. I beg your pardon. It's the best I can do at the time. I apparently am lucky to be alive. So this is the best I can come up with at the moment. So I hope you don't mind too much.
Not at all. We're very glad that you're able to come in and give as much as you have been able to give to the podcast. Thank you again for being able to come on, Virginia.
Well, it's my pleasure. I hate missing one. I do have to say, though, not having insurance, it would have definitely been a lot cheaper to just kick off. But, you know, I had to wait and see what the next book's going to bring. If it had been a few weeks later, you know, I might have changed my mind. But I just couldn't possibly let go 2 weeks before The Gathering Storm is released, not after waiting all these years.
Definitely. Well, in which case, that you have further reasons to continue, as we have two more books.
I know. Well, that's so far in the future. I'm not planning that far ahead at this point. I'm just going to be happy we've got at least one more right now.
I also wanted to mention that the base for all of the summaries that we have used throughout this recap of Knife of Dreams were originally provided and then edited by us from encyclopedia-watt.org. The people there have put together a wonderful and massive and thoroughly comprehensive catalog of not only chapter summaries, but character bios and appearance chartings, geography, history of the Wheel of Time, the various prophecies, various items you find. And it's, as we've always said, that, you know, we'll get pronunciations wrong from time to time because there are over, I want to say, what, 200,000 different names of people, places, and things, I think. I might be off on that particular number, but still, there's a lot.
About an order of magnitude. I think it's about 1,800 at last count. Characters, not places and everything else. You may be right. It may be millions if you get into place names and everything else.
Yeah, definitely. And literally, if you want to know something about the Wheel of Time, you can probably find good references for it on Encyclopedia Watt.
Yes, that's a really fabulous compendium of knowledge, and we rely heavily on it for research and data in addition to our own reading, and we want to thank them again for spending the incredible amount of time and energy to research all that and put it together. You know, we would have a lot harder time doing this podcast without such a wonderful resource to fall back on, and so we thank them again.
So, with that said, we begin this final installment with Chapter 34, A Cup of Koth.
Yes, or Who Not to Kill When You Invite Them Over to Coffee.
This chapter is from the point of view of Furyk Kareed. Furyk has searched for Tuan for nearly 4 weeks and is now located in a camp in north-central Altara. Many Shanshan troops believe the rumor that the Death Watch guards have a fake High Lady, so they're not readily cooperating with Furyk's troops. The Death Watch guards are Dalkove to the Empress herself. Ajimbura killed one soldier who insulted Kareed. Kareed left him in the forest with the Saldam and the Damane. He has 80 men and 21 Ogier gardeners with him. When Ogier fight, it is said that they are as cold as deep winter in Geronim. Most of the Rakan were sent west for some reason. Kareed leaves Captain Musenge and Hartha in charge of the men and enters the command tent. The officers in the tent are from many parts of Shanshan: Khoil, Dalinshar, Nakhon, Meshoakan, or Alquam. Banner General Gamel Loun sends out the rest of the officers. His manservant, Montwal, from Hujili, enters and serves Koff, a fine Ijaz mountain brew. After he leaves, Gamel Loun reluctantly tells Kareed the situation. His forces have been constantly harassed the last week by an unknown army. Men are torn apart by explosions in these battles. Gamel believes that they must have Ashaman or Aes Sedai, yet the Damane say that that the explosions were not caused by the One Power. Garot fell into a trap and lost several banners of men. Whoever leads the opposition is very, very good. Kareed wonders if Tom Marilyn is actually Aglamar Jagad or Gareth Bryn. He plans to make the best use of Saroth's involvement in the plot he suspects them to be concocting. General Cheeson is bringing his entire army in from the Malvide Narrows to help. Kareed thanks Gamel for his time and for the cough and leaves. Kareed tells Musenge and Hartha that they will head northeast for the Malvide Narrows, 4 days away.
Well, clearly the commander that they're talking about that is so very, very good is Matt. And clearly they have no idea of the tactics that he's using against them. I think he's just basically running circles around them militarily, which I think is kind of amusing for the ever-victorious army to be so undone by a single guy.
True. This is also our first real evidence that Aludra's dragon eggs are actually being placed into use, or at least smaller versions, something akin to grenades or sling-propelled explosives at this point.
Yeah, a lot's been made of the fact that Matt is basically changing the face of warfare by pretty much inventing cannons, gunpowder, you know, gunpowder and, you know, long-range explosives and stuff like that. It's been pretty well discussed. You know, it's been obviously alluded to in some of the visions and dreams that we've heard. So it's kind of a scary thing, and it's kind of sad in a way, although I suppose it's a useful balance for the common person against all those wielders of the One Power who've always been able to just, you know, do as they wished.
Yeah, definitely. It kind of balances the playing field a little bit. Kind of makes you wonder how they progressed to the point of the Age of Legends, where there were so many different, you know, things, and like the war breaks out, and they have things like shock lances, which are horribly devastating, and yet you hear nothing about advanced warfare techniques like explosives.
That's true, and they don't seem to really use the One Power in the Age of Legends as long-range battle, you know, tactics either. I mean, at least it's not mentioned much that I can remember.
Yeah, true. I mean, I think their biggest attempt at it was the construction of the Chodan Call.
Right, and then there was a lot of concern about that. Didn't really want them to be used because they were afraid they would have enough power to break the world if used improperly. And that basically was the whole problem leading up to, you know, Luz Theron having to break off and seal the boar himself with the 100 companions without any female channelers. It caused all kinds of ramifications.
Yeah, definitely. It should be noted that the reason most of the Rokkan have been sent west was Saroth's orders to pacify the rebellions in Taraban and to capture Rodel Itrald.
Right, and trying to, you know, resettle Taraban, which has been cast into chaos again. I also think one of the most amusing things in this chapter, and some of the previous chapters too, is the elaborate plot that they've concocted and attributed to Tom Marilyn. It's really funny. You know, they just assume all these things, and they've got this whole, you know, whole elaborate conspiracy built on a tissue of nothing. It's really hysterical.
Oh, and it's everybody. Like, Saroth and Creed and, you know, pretty much everyone who isn't Tuan believes that Tom is the, like, head spy for these Aes Sedai who've had this giant plot to kidnap the High Lady and throw off the Return. And Tuan, at least for a while, is of the opinion that all of the maneuvering and everything is actually Tom's doing as well. Until, you know, she finally, in these last couple of chapters, has started to realize that it actually is all Matt, and that he's, you know, far more capable and far more dangerous than he initially appears.
Right, and I think she's finally beginning to realize that he didn't kidnap her as part of any larger plot. It just sort of happened. You know, she was in the way when they were trying to make their escape, and they just drug her along. I'm sure that was a blow to her ego.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, getting kidnapped is one thing. Getting kidnapped by accident?
Yeah, because you were a nuisance. Getting kidnapped to reduce your nuisance value is really a, kind of a low blow, huh?
Especially one so high in the Imperial family.
I know. And she had everything from plots by her two sisters, nearest in age, you know, to the White Tower, you know, lined up as the conspiracy theories to account for her kidnapping and all the other things. It's just, it's so funny. It would have come down to realize that she just got kidnapped almost by accident.
It is also nice to see that the Shanshan are acting very predictably to Matt's tactics and doing exactly what he wants by pulling the armies out of the Mulvide Narrows.
Yeah, he really does have a pretty good lock on them. It's kind of a shame that you know, Rand didn't have access to Matt's abilities. When he faced the Shanshan near Altara, he might have done a little bit better off of them. And in the midst of all this chaos and everything, they're all still jockeying with each other, you know, for increased power and everything. You know, Suroth is trying to remove the general, and whose name escapes me at the moment, and she's planning to become empress, and the others are planning to remove her, and it's just like, oh, you know, these guys just never stop. It makes the game of houses look like nothing. I was really kind of charmed by the whole sharing of cough ceremony and everything. You know, they're sitting there thinking about how they might have to kill the other guy and so forth and so on, and yet they're still unfailingly polite. You know, it's very Oriental in a lot of ways. You know, very, a little bit Chinese, but almost more Japanese sort of outlook toward life, you know, the outward politeness, and yet the interface, which is never shown to anybody, you know, plotting and scheming and thinking about what else needs to be done and so forth.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's what kind of led to my shock when it was revealed that the Shanshan accent is supposed to be Texan.
I know. I've never quite really accepted that, but I've been trying to imagine it in my mind, and I think I'm getting a little bit closer. But then, you know, RJ was very fond of taking different sort of cultural stereotypes and so forth and mixing them up, you know. There are countless, too many to mention, instances of countries, you know, that are similar to what we have, and yet they're, you know, 180 degrees apart based on something else. It's pretty funny. One thing I think is kind of interesting is that both Randland and the Shanshan Empire have a wide range of looks of people, or, you know, races, if you will, you know, from dark to light and so forth and so on and everything. And it just doesn't seem to ever be an issue with anybody. There are national, you know, animosities and so forth and so on, but, you know, the person's, you know, race or skin color just never seems to enter into any of it. And that's kind of, you know, refreshing, actually, in a way.
Yeah. I mean, for one thing, it makes certain that the world is diverse. You know, not everybody is, you know, everyone from this nation is exactly this. Granted, you know, a lot of the Kyrianen tend to be short with, you know, pale skin and dark hair and dark eyes. But, I mean, there are certain small examples, but, you know, if you look at Andor, you know, you get an entire range of people where, coming down to the point that Rand's hair coloring is originally attributed to being, you know, from Camelon, or in that particular sort of area, as opposed to his actual roots in the Aiel homeland.
Well, half of them anyway. His other half was royal family in Andor at that point. Tigraine, obviously.
That's true.
She became Aiel, but she wasn't. But it was said that a lot of the royal family in Camelon had almost Aiel coloring. I think there is a lot of diversity. Robert Jordan fell a little bit into the trap that a lot of science fiction and fantasy writers doing of making entire countries homogenous for a lot of traits. You know, all the Kyrianen wear their clothes a certain way and so forth and so on. All the Damani dress a certain way, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's just like the science fiction writers, you know, somebody goes to a planet and all the people are dressed in a certain style or whatever. You know, that just never happens. So, you know, he got the diversity of the peoples right, but he still kind of fell into the trap of the national customs and dress codes and everything just being a little bit too lacking in personal individuality, if you will. But it's okay. You know, you can live with that. It's such a vast world. That's being really nitpicky.
Yeah, true.
So, anything else? We do have the, I think this is, as you said, the first time that we see the fireworks modified into hand grenades thrown with slings. I think that's interesting that he used slingmen to deliver the things. I would have really thought that he might have, you know, made smaller lofting tubes or something to do that, but I suppose maybe it's a little bit more accurate to use the individual targeting of a person in a sling.
Well, I also think that, I mean, right now they're on the move, and I kind of guess that the smaller sling or hand-thrown explosives are just the best they can do without actually having access to someone who can manufacture proper lofting tubes. You know, that, and I actually thought it was nice that they had, you know, pole-mounted slings. We'll find this out in a later chapter, but they have the pole-mounted slings in order to throw the eggs further, and that's kind of a nice thing to see that they were taking into account. Okay, you don't hold this thing in your hand, light it, and then throw it.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. it must have been hard for them to come across the ability to manufacture some of the things that she wanted on the move. And that's actually one of the things that bothers me a little bit about, several of the things. There's mention of the Aiel maidens going into battle with long red scars tied around both arms so that the non-Aiel could differentiate them from the Shaido. Well, these guys have been on the move for weeks. Where did they come up with all these bolts of red cloth to make red streamers for their arms? You know, come on. But that's okay.
Well, they just shredded a few of the Banner of the Light.
Yeah, right. Well, it was just sort of like that town where Matt took them shopping for bolts of silk, you know. Now, here it is, a medium-sized town, and it's got how many dressmakers? Come on. You know.
Sometimes it's good to be Teverin.
Yeah, apparently so. And it works so far in advance, too. It's really, really cool. Okay, then we'll move along to Chapter 35, The Importance of Dailin. This chapter starts from Elaine's point of view. The two parties of nobles from the uncommitted houses have arrived outside Camelin 2 days ago. Hansel Renshar, grandson of Arathel, has had an audience with Elaine and Dailin. He brings a request for safe passage so that the nobles may have an audience. Mistress Harfor is in attendance. Birgitta is dealing with reports. The nobles have 60,000 armsmen, more than Elaine has, even with the support of Kyron, Anshar, and Baron. Some of their armsmen left with Jared Sarand, and Dailin has called on Danine Kaindraed again, but she still will not commit. Many are still staying away from Camelin for fear of Aramilla's army. Elaine writes out the order for safe passage for Lord Luan Noellen, Lady Arathel Renshar, Lord Pelivar Coelan, Lady Aemlyn Carand, Lady Elorian Tremaine, and Lord Abel Pendar, and requests an audience that afternoon in the Grand Hall to discuss the Borderlanders. Elaine asks if Dailin wants to be queen, and she again says no. She thinks that Elaine is the better ruler, partly because of her connection to Rand, and partly because she watched her growing up and thought that she would just be the best one for the job. Elaine signs death warrants for the turncoat mercenaries, Rhys Ab Alamon and Aldred Gomaison. Evard Cordwyn, another turncoat, died in the battle. She denies a reward for Hafin Bhagavan, as he was just doing his job. The prisoners are not talking. Melar only swears. I guess that's nothing new. Denny's guardswomen have beaten him severely. Elaine had the great serpent rings of the Black Aja melted, even though that was Egwene's prerogative. Elaine orders Halwyn Nori to request the loan of Lady Sylvace's secretary. She misses Avienda very much. After mid-morning, Melfane Dawlish arrives with Asande, Naris, and Stephanie to examine Elaine. She is Elaine's new midwife. Though Birgitta has been drinking too much because of the loss of Gael Kane, she has now stopped. She has Julania Fote and Kawaila stationed in the nobles' camps to give the alert if they begin to move. Aramilla, Nyan, and Elenia are under guard. Musicians play while Elaine waits for the nobles, and she wonders how Tom is doing. Mr. Harfor announces the arrival of the nobles. Cassail leads the guardswomen who escort her to the Grand Hall. It is decorated with images of the women who built a strong nation out of the rubble of Artur Hawkwing's empire. Dailin is already there talking with Sylvaes, Conall, Catalin, Branlin, and Perival. Lyr and Karin are nearby. Mistress Harfor escorts in Luan, Arathel, Pelivar, Aemlyn, Ilorian, and Abel. Wine and Tremalkin black tea are served. Luan says that they have come to ask for a truce. Dailin says she published her support of House Treravan for Elaine. This ruins the other nobles' plans for her to be queen. Luan says that they still need a truce to deal with the Borderlanders, and Elaine explains how she dealt with them. They should be on their peaceful way to Mirandino. Ilorian is furious but cannot come up with a better way to deal with them. Elaine makes it clear that she dealt with them as an Aes Sedai of the Green Aja rather than the daughter heir or queen. Abel asks now what her plan is for the Black Tower. She says she has no plan. She is no more able to act against them than she would be if the entire White Tower were to appear suddenly in the vicinity. Abel and Luan then say that they now stand for Trakand. After something, Aemlyn do so as well. Elaine knows that they are actually doing it for Dailin. Ilorian leaves in a huff, saying she needs to get back to her estate at Sheldon. Elaine now has the throne, but half her support is suspect and tenuous. She wonders how long it will be before Andor must ride to the last battle.
Yeah, one of the things that seems really interesting to me, we mentioned that Dailin and her reasons for not wanting to take the throne herself She states that, you know, Elaine is the better ruler, partly because of her connection to Rand. And, you know, that takes me back to, and I don't remember which book it is now, when Rand is actually holding Camelin, and he has a number of conversations with Tylin. And she more than once kind of hints that, you know, he seems to be an awful lot, you know, in her recollection, you know, like Tigraine, or, you know, like the women who actually, you know, are of Rand's lineal descent. And so, you know, I've kind of wondered if, you know, Dylan actually has more info than we know about. You know, she, of course, favored Rand when he was in Camelin, and she's really supportive of Elaine, somewhat because of Rand. We know that there were at least two foretellings that link the royal line of Andor to success in the last battle. One by Giotara Morosa, which sent Tigraine into the Aiel Waste in the first place, and one by Elaida, which she hasn't really shared, but was the reason that she attached herself to Morghese in the first place. It just kind of makes me wonder if Dylan has access to more information than she has shared with us.
That's a really good thought. She certainly was in a position to have known Tigraine, perhaps, and her brother Luke as well. Maybe she did know more about it than we know, but I suppose that's something for the future.
Am I remembering properly or not, or Dylan does actually know that Rand is the father of Elaine's babies, right?
I'm not sure she does. Did she ever really dispel that notion? I think she stopped promoting it, that David Hanlon was the father, but I don't know if she ever formally repudiated it.
For some reason, I want to say, and it might be someone else, I wanted to say that Dylan kind of made an intimation that she knew that the, you know, the servant who came to see Elaine in the royal palace wasn't really a servant at all, that, you know, it was actually Rand.
I don't remember that at all, but she could well be right. She's very perspicacious, so she might well have, you know, figured that out. Well, the other thing is that I always thought that Rand's disguise was so unbelievably hideous that it made him remarkable. He would have done much better, I think, to be somebody, you know, very nondescript and ordinary that just wouldn't have been noticed very much. You know, for him to be so ugly as to be remarkable and to cause comment, you know, about Elaine's taste and all this other stuff was just stupid. Rand gets some really crack-brained ideas sometimes. Well, he and Elaine will go really well together, actually. They can have crack-brained ideas together. I wonder if Birgit will be able to keep them in line at all.
Again, also in this chapter, we have a mention of Jacques Lonald, the experienced torturer and secretary to Sylvaes.
Yeah.
You know, minor character, keeps getting mentioned. Kind of disturbing.
I know. He does get a lot of, as you put it, FaceTime for somebody who's really a very minor character. It makes me wonder if he's going to pop up in some capacity later on. I'm surprised that Elaine would actually send for him to interrogate the David and the Black Sisters. She seems to be so adamantly opposed to using that sort of, you know, method.
True. I mean, particularly with the White Tower having specific protocols for the questioning of sisters.
Not to mention jurisdiction over them.
Yeah, true. It's interesting. Encyclopedia Watt had a note, which I definitely had to include in this particular chapter summary, that the reason apparently that the Black Sisters are refusing to talk is that the oaths that the Black Aja take prevent Black Sisters from giving away useful information.
That's true, but I don't know how Elaine's going to get around that with just, you know, a torturer who used knotted cords. Sounds like a job for a Tarangriel to me.
The Chair of Pardon.
Yeah, no, it wasn't the Chair of Pardon. It was the Chair of Remorse. The one that they used to question Talene.
Yes, because the Chair of Pardon is actually a person.
Right, like the Armolyn seat. Yeah, and who's going to... Yeah, we've mentioned this before, but who's ever going to volunteer for that position when they possibly, potentially face the same sentence as the person they're defending? No. I don't think I want to volunteer for that, thank you.
Incidentally, we had a comment posted by Melanie on the comment section of episode 57. She says, just my thoughts on the Chair of Pardon, making the person who serves here share the consequence of the verdict with the accused would serve the purpose of making sure that the accused, quote-unquote, defense attorney would put every effort into proving their innocence. I have not heard that the concept of innocent until proven guilty applies anywhere in Randland aside from Abu Dhabi women killing their husbands. This would also help prevent mock justice where the verdict was a foregone conclusion and the Chair of Pardon was just another hanging judge. So definitely a good thought there, Melanie, and you do have a very valid point that if I, as the defense attorney, stand to face the same consequences as the person I'm defending, I'm going to put every effort I can into making certain I have my best interests in mind.
Yeah, not only that, I want to make sure I make every effort into believing that they are actually, you know, innocent of the charges before I defend them. I would not want to volunteer for that in 99% of the cases. I just think that's asking for trouble. Anyway, we got off a little bit on a tangent on there, but I think that probably wraps up that chapter. I wonder what Egwene's going to say when she finds out that Elaine is usurping some of her authority, melting down their rings and so forth and so on. I see a tongue-lashing in her future. Does one of the prophecies say anything about Elaine will face the Amarylline seat in all her anger?
No, just a vision that says her babies will be born healthy.
Okay.
At this point, we shift back from Camelin to Altara once again. Chapter 36, Under an Oak, begins with another point of view by Furyk Kareed. Furyk rides through the trees towards the Mulvide Narrows, a couple of leagues away. The road from Abu Dhar to Luggard is about a mile south of them. Ajambura found the camp where Tuan has been is being held. Kareed and Musenge think that his plan is a long shot. Kareed brought a small party, including Ajambura, a couple of guards, Hartha, and a couple of gardeners, and the Suldam Militene and the Damani Mylan. The rest have stayed behind with Musenge in case this camp is a trap. Kareed shudders when he thinks of healing touching him, but he wonders if it could have saved his wife, Kalia. They enter the camp and note that there are only 7,000 or 8,000, or not nearly enough troops, to do the damage which was described earlier by Gamel. A man rides up and introduces himself as Talmanis de la Vende. He recognizes the Death Watch guard armor from Matt's description. Kareed asks, of course, to speak with Tom Marilyn. Talmanis takes him to an oak where there are several people relaxing. He recognizes Satel Anon from the Wandering Woman. She recognizes him, and he wonders if the plot is even more intricate than the seeker who approached him thought. He thinks a woman in another group of four is Aegyanin Tamarith. Talmanis introduces Kareed to Tom. Three Aes Sedai, calling themselves Julin, Teslin, and Edesina, rush up. They recognize Mylan as someone called Shireen. Tuan and Seleucia ride up with a young man whom Kareed recognizes as Tylan's toy. Ajambura leaves to report to Musenge. Taking his gamble, Kareed addresses Tom, telling him that General Cheeson is returning to the Mulvide Narrows and will be here in 2 days. If he releases Tuan now, Kareed will let them go and into the Mulvide Gap and avoid destruction. Tom points Kareed towards Matt and tells or informs him that Matt, in fact, is the general. Matt says Cheeson is actually 5 days away and heading in the wrong direction, but that it isn't important. He asks Kareed if he can, or if Kareed can safely assure Tuan's return to the Teresian Palace. Kareed is absolutely stunned by this. They both know that most of the Shanshan army is actually trying to kill Tuan under false pretenses. Matt then asks Tuan if she trusts Kareed, and she says that she trusts him more than anyone, and asks Kareed if he still has her doll, which she has given to him. He says that, unfortunately, he lost it in the fire at Sohima. She commiserates with him over the loss of his wife and son. He is overwhelmed that she kept up tabs on him over such a long period of time, especially after having risen so high. Matt tells Kareed to take Tuan and Seleucia. At that point, Tuan announces 3 times that Matt Cawthon is her husband. Matt Cawthon is her husband. Matt Bloody Cawthon is her husband, thereby completing the marriage ceremony which Matt unwittingly began back in the Teresian Palace. Kareed is, of course, shocked to his boots.
Yeah.
From here, our point of view shifts back to Matt. Matt is shocked to his boots.
Again? 2 of them? There's a lot of that going around.
Yeah, I know. Everybody in this chapter is completely shocked to their boots. Or at the moment that Tuan completes the marriage ceremony, the dice which have been rolling in his head suddenly stop. He asks her why she doesn't act as if she loves him. And Tuan is relatively surprised by this comment. She informs him that the blood marry most often for politics, not love, though she does not deny that love is actually possible. She asks how he knew that she would complete the ceremony, and he briefly tells her about the Aelfin and the Aelfin and the Twisted Red Doorway. She, of course, doesn't believe him, but Edesina does confirm that there is a Twisted Red Doorway, or was, and that it does lead, purportedly, to a place where one can meet the Finns. Tuan then tells Matt about the foretelling from the Demane Lydia. That particular foretelling was, "Beware the fox that makes the ravens fly, for he will marry you and carry you away. Beware the man who remembers Hawkwing's face, for he will marry you and set you free. Beware the man of the red hand, for him you will marry, and none other." His ring, of course, shows a fox startling 2 ravens into flight, and 9 crescent moons. He remembers Hawkwing's face because of the memories that were given to him by the Finns. He leads the band of the Red Hand, and he carried her away only just now to set her free to go back to Abu Dhar. When this last part was completed, Tuan knew that Matt was indeed the person the foretelling was talking about. Vanden rides up at this point with news that there are 10,000 soldiers nearby. There is a 100,000 crown reward for killing Tuan. Now, Matt tells Kareed to go on, but to leave some of the Death Watch guards and gardeners so that the soldiers will think that Tuan is still in the camp with them. The chapter concludes with Tuan's point of view. Tuan and Seleucia pack lightly. Tuan makes certain to take the silk rosebud cluster which Matt had made as a gift to her along with her. She only says goodbye to Mistress Anan. She reflects that she thinks she might come to love Matt eventually. Her mother, the Empress, supposedly had loved her father. Back in the Death Watch guard camp, she announces that she has removed the veil. She is once again the daughter of the 9 moons. And Kareed proudly says that if they die, they will die as who they are.
Clearly, this is one of the most pivotal chapters in the book. Matt finally gets married. Woo!
Marriage is what brings us together today.
Poor Matt, shocked to his boots. That always makes me think of the scene in Camelin where he got lightninged by Robin and blown out of his boots.
He literally was shocked to his boots.
He was that time. And lived to tell about it. Poor Matt, finally married, and to a noble, to an imperial yet. But, you know, we've got to look at the Sistervirin work. It just had to happen. And wasn't that touching that Tuan takes the little silk rosebud cluster and wraps it up carefully as if it was blown glass? You know, I think she really does have fondness for him.
True. I think she actually denies that she loves him. And, you know, oh, I might come to love him. I don't know. That seems like a lot of care to be placing in it. But, I mean, we do know that Tuan has a good amount of caring for people who are close to her. I mean, she has kept tabs on Kareed over his extremely long career, you know, managed to keep up. I mean, she knows about the loss of his family, and, you know, she even kind of idly wonders about her doll, which, according to Encyclopedia Watt, and this just goes to show you exactly how detailed they are in their research, Encyclopedia Watt actually did recall that in Crossroads of Twilight, the doll's name was actually given. The doll is named Amella.
Yes, I remember that distinctly. She gives it to him when he's been wounded trying to protect her, and she comes over to, I guess, his stretcher or whatever and gives him the doll and says, Amella will protect you. Well, she can't really, of course, but, you know, it's to make you remember me and know that if you call my name that I will always hear, and so forth and so on. She actually does have a soft spot for people. I think she tries to be tough, you know, because she's tiny and she's kind of fragile looking and has a delicate face and so forth, and, you know, she knows that she needs to be really, really, you know, a badass to be able to take over the Empire. But, you know, deep down inside, I think she's actually a pretty nice person.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it's also nice to see that both of them, I kind of found it a little ironic, now that we finally have what the foretelling was, both of them had foreknowledge of their marriage to someone that they weren't going to know. And it's kind of nice in my mind that both of them had the same sort of immediate reaction. You know, he's like, you know, what do you mean I have to marry the daughter of the Nine Moons and that? He's like, it probably means it's a bloody noble and you know, Tuan apparently, you know, had Lydia beat rather soundly for this particular foretelling. You know, just the idea that, you know, this was obviously not what she had planned. And it's nice to me to see that both of them had this initial adverse reaction to learning about their marriage in advance, and yet they're both coming to understand the other a lot better, and they both actually are displaying legitimate signs of, you know, love or affection for the other.
Sort of a shotgun wedding, you know, Finn and Aes Sedai style, I guess, with the foretellings and everything. Yeah, and really, you know, this ties up actually a lot of little plot lines. It's really kind of a pivotal chapter. I was kind of surprised that she didn't catch him in the lie about remembering Hawkwind's face. You know, she's usually really good at that sort of stuff, and she was surprised she didn't catch it either. But, I mean, what an off-the-wall question to ask somebody. I mean, how is anybody going to remember Hawkwind's face thousands of years ago? I think the other funny thing is that she's still riding around on that razor. I mean, just the mental image of that, you know, the thing strikes me as looking a bit like a zebra. So here she is, this tiny little dark woman riding around on this stripy horse. It's like, oh my God.
Yeah, by Wheel of Time standards, it's a really, really good horse to have.
Apparently so. I know in this day and age, taming zebras is no easy trick, but I guess they're a little more amenable to breaking and taming it in the Wheel of Time world. But still, you know, could you get any gaudier?
I don't know. I mean, maybe if you wore, you know, a high-collared long green coat with large amounts of lace spilling from your chest and wrists and, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah, but he rode a plain, you know, dust color. No, that was Tom's horse. I guess he's a dun, Pips or whatever, but just a plain brown horse.
True.
I've never been all that sure about all the lace. I know it's been very popular at various points in time during our European history in particular and so forth and so on, but it just doesn't appeal to me on a guy. I'm not that crazy about lace on women either. You know, it's sort of affected.
Yeah, I've never been too much of a fan of lace myself either. Would be one of the only drawbacks to playing Matt, if ever the opportunity came about.
Oh, if the opportunity came about, you'd be throwing that lace on so fast, everybody's head would spin.
Oh, yeah. I don't deny that.
So what else can we glean from this chapter?
It seems to me like I should be able to pull something about the Death Watch guards, or the gardeners or something, but really, not so much.
Yeah, again, you know, with the plot by Tom, you know, the head spy of the White Tower and so forth and so on, that's just so amusing. I mean, he would be a master spy if he put his mind to it, but, you know, he's really not. And if they knew him, you know, the White Tower is the last person that Tom Maryland would want to be working for. He wants almost less to do with Aes Sedai than Matt does.
I do think that kind of leads into the thing that Tom is notable for his skills in the great game. And, you know, because he's, you know, he plays the game so well in that, I mean, it seems like a logical conclusion that, you know, someone has to be very skilled in the great game in order to pull off such a massive conspiracy. Now, it's, you know, the idea is that the conspiracy itself was flawed to begin with because it implies that the Aes Sedai consciously knew that the Daughter of the Nine Moons had come when she did, knew where she was, and found some way to abduct her.
Yeah, that implies a level of omniscience that I couldn't even ascribe to Aes Sedai, no matter how good they are. But it's just a really funny thing, and I think the other funny little twist that just popped into my head about this is that if there are two people in the Wheel of Time who really want so little to do with Aes Sedai other than Matt and Tom, and yet those two guys, their fates seem to be bound up so completely with Aes Sedai and women who can channel that it doesn't seem like they're ever going to get away. And of course, I am presuming that there will indeed be some relationship between the hopefully rescued Moraine and Tom Maryland, but they're certainly not getting what they want. Now we move on to Chapter 37, which is entitled Prince of the Ravens, or How to Have the Undisputed Best Title in the Series. Yeah, I have to agree with that, Andrew. Definitely beyond cool, or as Lee Butler would say, made of awesome. And this chapter begins with Matt's point of view, appropriately enough. Matt rides Pips as he prepares his forces for the Shanshan army engagement. Musenje leads the Death Watch guards. He addresses Matt as Highness constantly. They are in a broad field with only one easy entrance, courtesy of Master Royadel's maps. Matt hopes they do not get a whiff of Kareed, Tuan, and Seleucia. Aludra prepares her weapons. Noel, Oliver, Julin, Amathura, Tom, and Sital and On stay with the pack animals, even though Haman and the other Red Arms have been teaching Oliver to fight. Thalwin and Doman are with Aludra. Teslin, Edesina, Jolin, Fen, Blerik, Seta, and Bethaman are with the soldiers, though the two Soldam are forbidden to fight. Musenje asks Matt why he is not wearing his armor, and Matt quotes Kamadrin, "A general who draws his sword has put aside his baton and become a common soldier." Suddenly, Van and two of the Death Watch guard, Hartha and another Ogier, come out of the trees at a gallop. Shortly, the Shanshan army comes after them, also at a gallop. Aludra sends up a Nightflower to keep their attention forward. The crossbowmen attack them from the front. Talmanis and his cavalry attack them from behind. 50 slingmen throw hand grenades crafted by Aludra. When the Aes Sedai feel in danger, they begin to throw fireballs as well. A lancer named McCall carries the banner of the Red Hand. It bears the slogan, Daviende Setovia Sagain. It's time to toss the dice in the old tongue. The battle is soon over, though. Matt is closely brushed by several arrows, which snag in his clothing, and Matt begins to wonder if he shouldn't start at least wearing some armor at times like this. Hartha goes to find the leader of the Shanshan attack force, the traitor who wanted to kill Tuan. Musenji is suitably impressed with Matt's strategy. Hartha soon returns with the head. Musenji recognizes the man but will not say more. He says that they must take this to Tuan as fast as possible. Matt asks Musenji to call him Matt instead of Highness. Musenji is shocked, but not to his boots. That would lower his eyes forever because marrying Tuan made Matt Prince of the Ravens. Matt can only laugh at the bitter irony of becoming Imperial nobility. That's just too funny.
One of the things in this chapter that strikes me is that, you know, Kamadrin, you know, he quotes Kamadrin saying, you know, a general who draws his sword has put aside his baton to become a common soldier. And how often is Matt in the thick of things with Yashandari?
I know, it's pretty funny. But then, you know, Tavarin works both ways. He gets rescued and he gets pulled into this stuff, so I think it's just one of those things. He can't really stay out of the thick of it. But, you know, Matt doesn't really, up until probably the end of this book, I don't think Matt really ever really considers himself to be a general. I mean, he's just sort of in charge of the band. It just sort of happened, and, you know, his main concern is making sure the guys are all fed and that they don't get chopped to pieces every time they run into some, you know, Tavarin battles twist of fate. And it isn't really until the end of this book that he starts thinking of himself and his, you know, primary leaders like Telmanis and Darade and a few of the others as generals and lieutenant generals and so forth. I think he's finally resigned himself to the fact that this is his fate and he's not going to be able to avoid it.
Yeah, definitely. What is it? Somebody, I want to say it's the Finns, actually call him Lord of Battles. I mean, it's...
Son of Battles, wasn't
it? It is one of the... You're right, Son of Battles. And, well, I think someone else calls him Lord of Battles as well at some point. And maybe I'm off on that.
No, I think you're right on that. I don't remember when, though. Oh,
but yeah, I mean, it just seems like...
Avienda calls him Battle Leader.
True. I think everybody really does see it. And, yeah, this chapter really is about Matt kind of coming into his own as, you know, as they start to head toward Tarmon Gaiden. You know, Matt is going to be one of the essential generals, him and Perrin both, honestly. Perrin's strategies in Maldon kind of also put him in that, you know, category where, you know, suddenly we're going to have the tripod again. We're going to have, you know, Rand presumably being the focal point of the battle with Matt and Perrin making up the other two legs of the tripod.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, too, because I think if there's anybody that's more reluctant a battle leader than Matt, it's got to be Perrin. Surely he'll be leading some of his Two Rivers men and, you know, whoever else is still with him. And obviously, the unbroken line of wolves stretching to the horizon, that's been foreseen. That's going to be...
That's a lot of wolves.
Yeah, that's going to be a sight to see. I'll be shocked to my boots.
This chapter is also really nice because we actually see the dragon's eggs, or at least the mini dragon's eggs, getting used. We heard about it earlier, but this is our first actual, you know, sight, and... This is the description here. Each cylinder erupted with a roar and a burst of flame, some on the ground, some as high as a mounted man's head. The explosion was not the real weapon, though a man struck in the face was suddenly headless. He stayed upright in the saddle for 3 strides before toppling. Noaludra had wrapped a layer of hard pebbles around the powder inside each cylinder, and those pierced flesh deeply when they hit. Shrieking horses fell to thrash on the ground. Riders fell to lie still.
Yep, high explosives.
For anyone who has played any of the games in the Warcraft series, this reference is for all of you. We've got explosives!
Oh my god. I don't play WoW, but I can just imagine.
I think the first use of that particular phrase was Warcraft 2, back when it was not a massive multiplayer online role-playing game.
That's very cool. So you want to date my avatar? She's a real star. Hotter than reality by far. I know, you're shocked to your boots.
Yes, our next episode will be entitled Shocked to Our Boots.
I think that needs to be a chapter in Towers of Midnight. Let's call Brandon.
Shocked to their boots by the messenger cow.
I love it.
I also kind of, it was one of those things that I think would be really neat in a movie or a TV series, that when you have this battle, suddenly the battle is over and you get Hartha, the massive gardener in his black or in his red and green armor, standing up and announcing that he is going to find the traitor, and his massive form lumbering into the massive amounts of dead on the battlefield. Because I think at one point they kind of describe it as, bodies piling up like walls or something like that.
Yeah, they had to have somebody drag away the bodies so they could get out of the square that they were in, the square that was formed around them. Pretty nasty. Yeah, I think the Ogier definitely have some pretty cool, scenes to play if they ever do make a series or a movie. I really opt for the Stargate SG-1 treatment, personally. I wish they would just do a long television series stretching over years, because I don't think anything else is going to do this series justice. No movie is ever going to be able to do this justice.
True. Honestly, the story would have to be adapted so that it takes place over a longer period than 2 years. There's too much that needs to be covered that I don't think they could do it and try to keep up believability, or outside of doing something like a 3D or an animated picture, that you couldn't keep actors and actresses from aging over the immense amount of time that these now future 14 books will require.
Yeah, that's a good point. Even in Stargate, it actually did cover many years, and they did age and nobody thought too much about it. But that would be a problem in 2 years' time. Yeah, that would be even more tricky than trying to get the Harry Potter things done, 7 years of school and how many years of movies? Especially since these kids are supposed to be young, they're all in their late teens, so, it's not going to work to have a 30-year-old playing them after, supposedly only a year has passed.
Yeah, I know, that's...
Nobody looks that
good. Who knows? They pulled it off before, but I just think you'd be having to replace actors eventually to try to get, to keep up. And I've seen series where they replaced actors with other actors, and it was just like, really? Is this supposed to be the same character she was 2 seasons ago? Babylon 5?
Yeah, it just never really, really works that well. It reminds me of one of the Star Trek conventions when the fans were asking if there would be another Next Generation movie, and Brett Spiner, who plays Data, the android, said, who has aged remarkably in the last 10 years, said that, I don't know about everybody else, but we're all getting older, and as far as Data goes, unless they develop an aging chip, no.
True. There's only so much you can really do with the makeup in order to keep the effects of time at bay.
Yeah. It only works for so long, no matter how good you look. Anyway, we digress. So I guess the other thing that kind of I wanted to mention in this, it's just sort of a pet peeve of mine. These Aes Sedai in battle, they have to wait until they feel like they're in danger. I mean, Matt is getting his clothes pinned by arrows, and Jolene still doesn't feel like she's in danger yet. Oh, come on, woman. Throw the fireballs already.
Or, take a step to the left.
Yeah. Move a little closer. Duh.
I mean, the oath doesn't prevent you from putting yourself in harm's way.
Yeah. Like, ride in there a little bit closer or something. Jeez, woman. Arrows flying all over the place and you don't feel in danger? Well, what about everybody else? Oh, I've been shot through the heart.
Well,
I definitely feel in danger now.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing that's always kind of bothered me about that particular oath, is that, I will only use the one power, or I will not use the one power as a weapon, except in the last defense of myself, another sister, or my warder. And my thought here is, okay, that seems amazingly limited, How about I will not use it as a weapon, except in defense of others or something like that. It's something that would allow for a little more. I mean, you're supposed to be servants of all, and yet at the same time, oh, I'm sorry, small peasant person. You're getting attacked by an army. I can't do anything to help you because I don't feel in danger.
Oh, too bad, innocent bystander. You are now collateral damage. Oh. But I kept my oath. Yeah, it doesn't... I hate it. I hate that whole concept. I think they need to be able to defend, you know, innocent bystanders, if nothing else. You know, people who are being threatened unjustly or anything else. I don't know. Anyway, enough of my ranting about the Aes Sedai and the Three O's. I guess it's the green in me. I just want to be part of the battle. I don't want to wait around.
So, we will conclude this episode with the epilogue. Remember the old saying. The epilogue begins with Suroth's point of view. Suroth is in the military headquarters of the Teresian Palace with Captain General Galgan. As Semirog promised, a ship has arrived with news of the death of the Empress and rebellion within the Empire. They are studying a map of the Arad Domain. Banner General Ephraim has a report from Turan that 100,000 men joined Itrald ahead of the Shanshan army, and then 200,000 closed in from behind them, thereby trapping the Shanshan army. Galgan has signed orders promoting Banner General Tylee Kiergan to Lieutenant General and has raised her to the Low Blood. He has also signed orders to return the Rocken to Amadisia and Altara. Jacen still has not located the army causing trouble in northern Altara. Dwan enters, accompanied by the Death Watch guard and gardeners. She has heard of the death of her mother and commands Kareed to show everyone what Captain Musengje has brought her, the head of Zareed Elbar. This, of course, is direct proof that Suroth was behind the attack. Tuan meets eyes with Galgan, Albadar, Yulon, Yamanda, all of the blood in the room except Suroth. She announces that Suroth Sebel Meldaroth is no more. The Death Watch guard may have the new Dolkove until her hair has grown long enough for her to be sold on the block. Suroth wails in agony as the Death Watch guard then proceed to cut off her clothing. From here, we switch to the point of view of Pavara. Pavara, Javindra, Desala, Tarnafir, Jezreel, and Melare travel from the Ogier Grove in Tarvalon to the Black Tower. Pavara has learned the Warder Bond from Yukiri. Tsutsama ordered Javindra to come because Pavara and Tarna could not select enough reds themselves. They had plenty of reports on the Black Tower from eyes and ears within Camelon. Three men meet them at the gate. A dedicated and two soldiers, those being Eren Kazan and Samal Alsin. Pavara asks to see the Mahail. The dedicated opens a gateway and steps through. Half an hour later, he returns through a larger gateway and leads the group of Aes Sedai past a white stone platform with a black stone on top of it toward a palace decorated in red and black with the sigil of a gauntlet holding lightning bolts. A Tyrian full Ashaman leads them to a throne room where 100 mean-looking Ashaman stand around Taim. He curtly asks them what they want. Pavara explains that they wish to bond men who can channel as warders. After all, they have confirmation that the Ashaman have bonded 51 Aes Sedai. Mishrael starts to mouth off, but Taim knocks him across the room with air. Melare offers to heal Mishrael, but Taim refuses. He says that as a lesson, he will be healed at the end of the day if he survives that long. Taim quickly agrees to their request, surprising the sisters in the group. He tells them to remember the old saying, let the Lord of Chaos rule. And he and the other Ashaman begin to laugh ominously.
Mean-looking Ashaman, huh?
Yeah, I know. It's like, hmm.
Yeah, well, they probably are mean-looking, you know? It's kind of hard not to be mean-looking when you're strutting around like they do. But, well, there's a lot of stuff going on in this epilogue here. It's almost as good as a prologue in a way, except it's a lot shorter. A lot of people have made much about the colors, you know, red and black of Taim also being the colors of Morden, and I don't know if that would be happenstance or not.
Well, I think a lot of us have gotten under the impression that Demandred was probably behind the Black Tower, but the more and more I think about it, it makes more sense if Morden were behind Taim's rise as a proto-incipient dreadlord.
Yeah, I have to kind of agree with that, too. It certainly is the sort of thing that, you know, Ishamael, now Morden, liked to do. Although Demandred was also known for liking to use proxies, so there's something to be said for both. It doesn't mean that, you know, we've seen multiple instances where more than one Forsaken has been meddling with certain individuals, giving them orders, often conflicting orders. So it's possible that both of them have had their influence. I think it's also significant that we've seen the sigil of the gauntlet holding lightning bolts before, several times. It was the one that was on the coach in that took the three girls to the Stone of Tyr, and it was also on the back of Samael's stone in Teleron Riad. And as I recall, wasn't it also the sigil of the merchant Hake very back in Eye of the World when the boys are trapped in the room and Rand channels lightning to blow the bars off? Wasn't that also the sigil on his coach?
That is a good question.
I really think it might have been.
Yeah, I'm looking for it at the moment. In The Dragon Reborn, Nynaeve saw a sigil painted on the carriage door, a silver gauntleted fist clutching jagged lightning bolts. She supposed it was a High Lord Saman, Baelal's sign. And in Fires of Heaven, his, Samael's chair, was heavy wood carved with a steel gauntlet, or gauntleted fist, clasping lightning at the back's peak. So it seems like the first appearance of it is actually on what we assume to be Baelal's carriage in Tyr.
You couldn't find it in Eye of the World in that incident with the boys?
No, Samael Hake was the innkeeper.
Oh, okay. Then it wasn't him. The merchant was the other guy. Oh, Goad.
No. On the coach doors was Howell Goad's name. And it was done in the style that he had seen in Whitebridge. That's how he identified the carriage in the Eye of the World.
Okay, thanks for looking that up. I'm sorry about that. False trail.
But we do know that previously both Baelal and Samael have used, presumably, the gauntlet clutching lightning bolts.
Yeah, it certainly seems indicative, you know, that something's going on. Although I suppose it's kind of an obvious sigil for a wielder of the One Power.
Interesting. Oh no, it was Arrows of Fire. Okay, yeah. I was going to say, there was also the side reference where Matt reaches up into the sky and grabs, I had wanted to say lightning, but now that I think about it, they were arrows of fire and hurls them at the ground and stuff. It was that premonition that Matt was going to invent cannons.
Oh, yeah, right. He reaches up and tries to grab the fireworks, not lightning.
Yeah, fireworks. That was.
Yeah. A lot of symbology in this book, really. A lot of it.
So we were talking earlier a little bit about the idea that it makes a little bit of sense for both Ishamael, now Moradin, and Demandred to be the ones responsible for the Black Tower. And it kind of just occurred to me a little bit. Of course, the Shadow at the current moment has very few, or at least up until this point, had very few people to actually be Dreadlords. And it makes sense that they needed to recruit or convert channelers to their cause if they were going to have any hope of having any amount of channelers in the last battle. Presumably, Messana is or was working on that in the White Tower. And so now the fact that, you know, the more I think about it, it's like, yeah, I could see Ishamael or Moradin or, you know, Demandred definitely looking at, oh, well, you know what, since Althor has just left us completely alone with this, let's make the full advantage that we can out of this and just, you know, set ourselves up with an entire factory to produce men who can channel for our side.
Yeah, I loved what one of the readers on Lee Butler's We the Time Read Through blog on Tor.com said when we were discussing that very thing, that Rand had created the Black Tower and then basically walked off and left it to its own devices. And he said, Black Tower, looks like Dreadlord Central to me. Yeah, I don't remember the name of the person who said that, but yeah, that kind of wraps it up.
You'll get no argument from me there.
Yeah, that was probably not one of Rand's brighter moves, leaving the Ashaman to their own devices under Mazrim Taim. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, since we're still talking about the section concerning the Black Tower, I wanted to make a note again, and we've brought this up a couple of times in the podcast before, but on their way to the palace, they pass a white stone platform with a black stone on top of it, and every time that I read anything about this stone, which has, you know, been the main stone where the Ashaman or anybody has made a speech from in the Black Tower, it was their central kind of speaking block, essentially, it takes me back to Egwene's dream in A Crown of Swords, Chapter 10. The dream says, Loghain, laughing, steps over something onto a black stone. It looks like Rand's body, but when she touches his face, it breaks apart like a paper puppet. I have always determined from this that that dream, taken in conjunction with Min's vision that Loghain has greater glory to come, is indicative that regardless of whether or not it's actually Rand, which I don't believe it is, that Loghain is stepping over. He is stepping onto that black stone, and that his future glory is tied to him taking control of the Black Tower.
Yes, I agree. That's probably the most likely interpretation of it, unless my favorite pet theory, possibly Loghain's been turned and he takes over the Dark Black Tower for the side of evil. I mean, the glory can be for the bad guys, too.
That's true. Yeah. The only issue I have with that is he's taking over the Black Tower from somebody evil for somebody evil.
Well, that's sort of what evil guys do, you know. The apprentice always takes over, you know, knocks off the master and then takes over the whole farm, right? Sort of like the Sith, you know.
Yes, but Darth Vader turned back to good when he knocked off his master.
Well, but that was an aberration.
You know, it's something about that it looks like Rand's body, but the face breaks apart. It seems to me that there has been something to make people believe that Rand was dead, when really it isn't.
Yeah, I think he's probably going to die, because the prophecy says so clearly in so many ways, you know, to live you must die. I just have to go with the obvious interpretation that he's going to be killed and then somehow brought back by healing. Or possibly massive amounts of balefire, but that could be tricky. Kind of like a little like time travel, you know, kind of gives me a headache.
Now, the first half of the epilogue, there's not really a whole lot there, except that, you know, Tuan comes in, she's dressed in mourning, which now, of course, I think has revealed that she's now going to have to go to Seanchan in order to presumably quell the rebellion and to assume her place as Empress. But other than that, really the only thing that I really got out of it, other than the fact that apparently Rodel Itterald has really done his job very well, because they've not only managed to coordinate a proper strike, but they've actually managed to pull a massive amount of Shanshan troops and managed to press them between and pocket them in between their own armies. So he's definitely done his job very well. The only other thing I really can note about it was, yay, Seroth got what was coming to her. Woohoo!
Oh, absolutely. She was right up there, well, not quite with Galena and Elida as my most hated characters, but she was really close. As much as she deserved, actually.
No, she didn't. But, presumably the Death Watch are not going to use her kindly until she goes to the selling block.
Yeah, it sort of beggars the imagination. I think I probably, there's worse fates. Not like she's, going to be tortured for the death of 10,000 tears or some of the other things that the Shanshan have.
True.
It doesn't sound as bad as an apology to the Empress if you want to get serious about it. I don't think it would be fun, but, And on the other hand, she actually got off pretty easy, because there she was under Semirog's thumb. She could have easily become prey to the master torturer herself.
Very true. Except, Semirog went off and got herself captured in an earlier chapter.
I know. But, that was just pure luck for Seroth, I don't think being the plaything of the Death Watch Guards is going to be anything approaching what Semirog would have done had she failed her.
Very true.
What else? Let's see. I don't know that it ever actually says that Tuan needs to go back to Shandar in order to be crowned. I think she can be acknowledged Empress on this side of the Arath Ocean. And I know I've said this before, I don't want to repeat myself too much, but I just can't see her at this point in time, at this crucial juncture in the events of the world, getting on a ship for several months, going back to Shanshan and then doing whatever she needs to do and then possibly coming back. I think she's going to have to use traveling in one form or another. Either somehow her Dermani are going to use it or learn it, or she's going to, because of Matt, possibly make use of Ashaman or something like that, or possibly even Randolph Orr will send her back home. Who knows? But I just don't think she's going to be able to be out of it for months on end, traveling back and forth on a ship.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't think that she can possibly... I don't think that she can be out for that long, particularly because at the rate that we are going... with books taking place over as little as time as a few weeks, that it seems that they're going to have time in these last three books to make a several month journey across the ocean.
Yeah, that's always been my contention, and I think she'll just have to break down and make use of either Aes Sedai or Ashaman traveling, something or another, or possibly the Shanshan will learn it, who knows. But I think it's going to have to go down that way. Otherwise, she's basically out of the game for the rest of the novels, as far as I could tell. And why go to all that trouble, to develop that character to that extent, and have all the things happen, and then have her just disappear until after Tarmann Gai? That doesn't make any sense to me.
True.
There are still prophecies to be fulfilled, darn it.
I actually think my original idea that made me convinced that Tuan would have to go back across the ocean seems to have come from somewhere within, I want to say, the prologue, where Semirog and Seroth are talking, and Semirog tells her that the Empress is dead. For some reason, I wanted to say that Seroth had an argument that, Tuan would have to go, or would have to return across the ocean. But I am not finding it as I am looking through it now, so I think my point is moot.
Well, I can't positively remember myself, so I'll leave that one up in the air for now. Oh, anything else? What about this old saying? I don't remember any old saying. It seemed like just a few books ago that one came up. Let the Lord of Chaos rule.
Yeah, well, and it's one of those weird things that, if I remember properly, unless it was supposed to be some sort of code during the Age of Legends amongst the Forsaken, then I don't think it's an old saying, regardless, because it seems like every time someone hears it, it's like, oh, remember the old saying, let the Lord of Chaos rule, and people are like, what? Seriously? How's that an old saying?
Well, unless you consider that the Forsaken being all as old as they are, that if they make up a saying at their age, it is an old saying, you know, as Lenny would say. I don't know, that's kind of a tricky way to put it. I like the idea of it being a, you know, Age of Legends code word or something.
Yeah, well, it seems like because when it's first introduced, you know, someone comes and is like, you know, I bring you a message. You know, he says simply, let the Lord of Chaos rule. And it seemed like a very awkward comment that they all seem to latch onto and understand. So I kind of have to guess that this was probably at some point a code word for a series of actions or a general category of actions that the Forsaken are to be taking.
Yeah, probably. I couldn't even begin to venture any more than that. I think that's very reasonable, and I like that idea. And do you think any of these Ashaman are actually going to allow these Reds to bond them?
Well, like I said, we don't have a whole lot of experience with what happens when someone is bonded to someone else who can channel. I mean, the only people we really know of it happening are Elaine, Avienda, Alana, and Rand.
No, we have all the Aes Sedai that bonded the Ashaman, like Jahar. Maurice bonded Jahar. And then we've got Loghain,
oh, that's right,
who bonded the Aes Sedai, you know, and the other Ashaman. There's a ton of them.
That's true. We haven't actually... Okay, I should amend then. We've not actually seen the direct effects of what happens when a channeler bonds another channeler. We've seen a number of instances where it's happened, but we've not seen long-term effects on it. I don't wonder if maybe it's kind of like the SAD bracelets or the male Adam, where eventually control of the bond could shift and work both ways. It's a minor theory. If it did work that way, that then by bonding Reds to Ashaman, who are, of course, dark friends, they would, through time, be able to gain and convert them to the Dark One without actually having to have the 13-13 combination. It could just be an expedient method to turn a whole bunch of Aes Sedai over to the Dark One.
Well, I'm going to have to come down on the side of the Aes Sedai whose name I do not remember, but when they get into a shouting match in the White Tower about, you know, Dark Friends and everything, one of the Aes Sedai, I think, screams at Pravara, you know, if you want to look for Dark Friends, look in the Red Aja. Well, yeah, I kind of go along with that. I don't want to get a lot of hate mail from all of you people who like the Red, but... that's what I think. So I don't think it's going to be much of a stretch, you know, for any of these Ashaman of Taim's who are Dark Friends, probably most, you know, to influence some of these Aes Sedai in that direction. I think that's where that's all heading up. And where else are they going to get all these Dreadlords? I don't know, you know, we don't know how many of those Aes Sedai that Elida sent there or how many of the Red Aja might actually already be Black Aja anyway. We don't know.
That's true. The other thing that this theory relies on is that bonding one channeler to another has a similar effect as the link that is created through the male Adam. I have no evidence to support it, but it just seems like a similar enough connection between two channelers that would allow for that kind of thing to be possible.
Well, the only real information that we get about the sad bracelets come basically from Mogedion. And, you know, she's kind of suspect as a source, you know, for truth and justice in the American way, if you don't know what I mean. But she seemed to think that the taint would seep through, and that was the biggest issue in trying to control a man, and that, you know, it frequently, you know, you could share it with two sisters to control the man, and that lessened the exposure. But I'd have to go back and read that chapter again. I really don't know if all of that seepage was mainly because of the taint, or if it was actually, as you say, an issue of the control, you know, lessening or strengthening between the two because of them both being able to channel. I kind of got the impression it was mostly the taint that was the problem, but I don't remember exactly, so I could be wrong.
I mean, it might have something to do with the taint. I don't really recall. It just seems like if there's eventual slippage back and forth, so much that the control can shift to the person wearing the collar, then they would have to have something more than just the effect of the taint itself.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to go back and research that a little bit more.
So, I think that we've pretty thoroughly gone over the remaining chapters in the epilogue of Knife of Dreams, thereby concluding our recap of the Knife of Dreams. If you, as the listening audience, have seen anything that we have missed, if you have any extra ideas, you really liked something, you really hated something, there are, of course, a number of ways that you can get a hold of us here at the Fourth Age. You can always, of course, call and leave us a voicemail at 1-888-333-7690.
You can also leave us an email at podcast@dragonmount.com. You can also follow us on some of the social networking media. We have a Facebook page. We'd like to invite you to become our friend and follow us on Facebook. Just send a request and mention that you're a listener of the Fourth Age, and we'll be glad to confirm you as a friend. We also have a MySpace page, and also you can follow us on Twitter. The username is Fourth Age. You can also follow dragonmount.com on Fourth Age as well.
In addition, on dragonmount.com, there is a Fourth Age forum page on www.dragonmount.com/forums. And if you go to www.dragonmount.com/podcast, there are individual postings of each podcast episode, and following each episode is a comments section where you can leave us comments. And there are always one or two of us who are perusing through those and offering in our own two cents or adding in revisions, corrections, or just generally hanging out. So definitely there are a number of ways you can get a hold of us to give us anything you want. Crazy theories, new ideas. There's a really nice forum page currently in the Fourth Age forum in which people are recounting their memories of their first reading of The Eye of the World.
Oh, very cool. I haven't seen that yet. But however you choose to contact us, we're always happy to hear from you, and we try to respond as quickly as possible. We do respond to all the emails that we get, and eventually all the voicemails that we get are going to show up in the podcast. I know we're a little bit tardy on the editing. We're trying to get better.
Yes, definitely. And speaking of editing, I would just like to say on behalf of everyone at the Fourth Age, if you have ever picked up the role of editor for the Fourth Age podcast, I and everyone, including many of the people who do the editing, would just like to thank you in advance, because none of our shows would be possible without the time and the effort of everybody who sits down and edits one of our episodes, because there is a lot that does get cut out, and we keep promising that a lot of it is going to make it into blooper reels at some point in time, and it may still happen, but a lot of it is really just minor things, even like editing out and little pauses where people don't completely express a thought as clearly as we would like to have in the final product. I definitely wanted to thank everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we just couldn't do it without the editors. We, you know, in an effort to kind of keep this an informal and fun conversation, as though we were, you know, friends sitting together talking about the Wheel of Time, we work without a script, pretty obviously, to try to keep a more natural feel to it and, you know, and bounce ideas off each other's heads. And we come up with a lot of things that way, I think, that we wouldn't be able to do if we were completely scripted. But that does make it a lot harder for the editors and also for us in a lot of ways, because we're basically working without a net. We try to research what we're going to talk about as much as we can, but, you know, during the course of a conversation, we range far and wide, and frequently, you know, we just don't have time to stop and look something up, or we don't have the resource materials with us. So we're basically doing this out of our heads, and we do make mistakes. So we occasionally misspeak, and we totally appreciate the patience that all of you have had as listeners in putting up with us, and we're really grateful for all of you, because we wouldn't be much point in doing the podcast without you guys there, and again, without the editors, we couldn't do it at all, so thanks. And also thank you to Jason Denzel and everybody, Jennifer Liang and Kevin Dean and everybody at Dragon Mount who provide us with an opportunity to put up this podcast and serve as the host site and do a lot of the work behind the scenes to help make everything work and fix the technical problems and so forth. It's this is going to be the big thank you to everybody. Oh yeah, and thank you to the late Robert Jordan and to Brandon Sanderson, because without them we wouldn't have anything to discuss.
Definitely a great deal of thanks to the authors.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing series. We all know that. We all love it for that reason. And I'm just really happy to be a part of this. And I think it's enriched my life, you know, to become so involved in the Wheel of Time and getting to meet all these new people and making new friends and everything. I think it's a really great experience. And so we hope that you feel the same way. So that wraps up this episode. That wraps up the recap of the Wheel of Time's Knife of Dreams. So this is Virginia saying goodbye for now, and may the light illumine you until we meet again.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravya Ninto Manshima, Tai Shi Tei.
Freeze way at 80%, stops time. Tell your friends.
We begin with, this chapter comes to us from the point of...
Although, I do have a 9mm, and that tends to be the great equalizer, doesn't it? I could make them scared pretty quick. Dance, I said I dance! Thank you, Mom. I said I meet the Old West.
So now I'm just imagining, you know, Elida running into Yosemite Sam.
Yeah.
Okay, this definitely needs to be edited out of the podcast, but if Elaine and Rand are both crack-brained, does that make their babies crack babies?
Yeah, pretty much. I would venture to say that very few of our listeners are crackheads whatsoever. I think you got to be pretty sober to...
Now, when we get an email from an irate crackhead...